Extraordinary Terrestrials, Part 3, Chapter 27, The Bog's Promise. Trip Smith gazed at his frown in the mirror, thinking about the evolutionary purpose of the smile. Most mammals made some kind of mimicry of the smile. Many were capable, at least. There was some kind of ape. What kind of ape was it? He muttered, trying to remember what he'd read once. He made a note to research it later. Maybe every kind of ape. Possibly every kind of ape was known to smile as a means of showing vulnerability, a yield sign. Trip didn't think that vulnerability was the only reason humans smiled, not always, nor did he think it was the reason he never smiled. He returned his attention to his toothpaste, which, as he'd been thinking, he'd squeezed not onto his toothbrush, but into the sink. He concentrated and tried again, this time succeeding. Trip brushed his teeth, his eyes returning to their reflection. He often made faces in the mirror for his own quiet amusement. It was good entertainment for a solitary soul. The faces had never hinted at a smile, or even a smirk, despite their unique variety. He couldn't smile if he tried. There were times when he wished he could. On some people, a smile seemed so natural and perfect. Trip thought of Maddie. He tried his best to stop. There were other times, of course, when Trip didn't think smiling was necessary at all. There were plenty of instances in which, even if he could smile, he wouldn't have. Because he never did, he noticed people couldn't tell if he was serious or not. He'd quickly learned to not care if he was serious or not. It made things easier for everyone. Maddie could usually tell when Trip was joking. He brushed his teeth with more vigor. Trip didn't know the exact reason he couldn't smile, but that didn't mean he was devoid of ideas. In fact, he had several very good ideas, one he'd never shared with anyone. Not even Maddie, though she'd probably figured it out by now. It was an idea having to do with his parents, as was the case with so many people's problems. Trip's parents divorced when he was 13. Looking back, they should have done it much earlier. Trip often wondered if the divorce would have been delayed even longer if he hadn't intervened in his own passive-aggressive way. When Trip was 12, not long after his encounter with a will-o'-the-wisp, he had another, far more upsetting encounter. He found his father crying in the woodshed. Trip's father was unaware of his son's watchful presence in the window. Trip had never seen his father cry. The man's shoulders shook. His face was red. His fist was pressed to his mouth. When Trip was 6, he didn't want to eat salmon. His father told him boys were not supposed to cry, especially over salmon. When Trip continued to cry, his mother struck him across the cheek. She'd made a very strong argument. Trip almost never ate salmon again, and he never cried again. He'd seen his mother cry many times, mostly during TV programs. Though a strong disciplinarian, she was hardly a tyrant and never struck Trip again after the salmon incident. Trip could never be sure how much of that was because she didn't like to hurt her son, and how much of it had to do with his efforts to never upset her again. Trip's father hated to be laughed at, though he was a very laughable example of a man. It caused a great deal of conflict because Trip's mother laughed very easily and loved pulling pranks. Her penchant for laughter often got her in trouble with her husband. And Trip, slung between a sensitive man who never cried and a jokester woman who wasn't allowed to laugh, found himself under a great deal of pressure. these issues between his parents could have easily been resolved if they'd simply talked it through, but Tripp's parents also happened to be two very stubborn people. They were people who refused to acknowledge a problem. They were people who pretended. Tripp's father would pretend he wasn't annoyed that he was too short to reach the coffee where his 5'9" wife had left it, and Tripp's mother would watch, pretending she didn't think it was funny, and Tripp's father would pretend he wasn't hurt that his wife was too busy not taking him seriously to lend a hand, and Tripp's mother would pretend she wasn't disgusted by her husband's short temper, and Tripp's father would pretend he wasn't wholly disturbed by the fact that despite loving this woman, he couldn't stand her, and Tripp's mother would have a similar realization. Eventually, the pretending would give way, but never when the two were in the same room. Tripp's father would abscond to the bathroom to throw a fist into the shower curtain. Tripp's mother would double over with laughter while the garbage disposal screeched and rumbled. Her laughs always had a doomed, unhappy, and confused cadence, as if they were saying, "How the hell have we come to this?" Nothing like Maddie's laughs. And Tripp would watch it all, the silent observer, hoping his stoicism would prevent involvement. It occurred to Tripp that he'd been brushing his teeth for a long time now. He glanced at the time, late again. He rushed downstairs, wondering how his thoughts had reached such a low. Dwelling on his parents' bleak past was worse than dwelling on Maddie's mysterious present. He pulled on a coat, unsure of how frigid it would be outside. Early April mornings could be unpredictable, sometimes thawing and sunny, other times icy and smelling of snow. Granted, it hadn't snowed once that winter. Not once. This had been convenient for Tripp's travels on bike, but it was also highly distressing. It wasn't supposed to rain in January, not in New England. Tripp had always liked snow, despite how much it could inconvenience life, but even more so, Tripp liked when the weather did what it was supposed to do. With the rain and Maddie's absence, it had been a very long winter. This was an understatement. It had been an utterly bleak winter, and still was. Tripp glanced in the kitchen and considered the prospect of breakfast. It stirred a dull nausea, as the thought usually did. He grabbed a rock-like granola bar for later. "Granite granola," he muttered. "Don't take your granola for granite." A soft meow came from the living room, and he remembered Fred. She hadn't been fed yet. Tripp opened a cabinet and brought out the dry food. The sound of the paper bag was enough of a summon. 4 small feet met with the hardwood floor. Fred ran into the kitchen, a blur of slate-gray fur. She gave a chirp and began to eat. Tripp gave her long, fleecy Maine Coon fur a stroke, regarding his one companion for a moment before making his way to the door. "Until this afternoon, Freddy," he stated as he stepped into the icy outdoors. To his right stood a large white pine with limbs that were and always had been excellent for climbing. That was a tree. That was the tree that had aided Tripp years ago. But he wasn't going to allow himself to think about that right now. He mounted his bike and took off, thinking instead of Maddie. Of course. She'd been gone for nearly 10 months now, without sending so much as a brief and meager response to his messages every now and then. Tripp had spent the months trying not to panic or give in to the dark assuredness that she wouldn't be back. Of course she'd come back. She was simply taking the semester off. She was taking both semesters off. Tripp chose to believe this, but controlling one's own mind was a subtle and difficult art. He passed house after house, frosted lawns and trees not yet ready to send out buds, their bare, elegant branches like veins in the sky. It was a beautiful morning, but Tripp's breath wasn't taken away until he reached the corner of Munson that met with Blueberry Lane, until he reached Bloodsworth Bog. He noticed the tamaracks had begun their reproduction of pale green needles. As with every morning's journey alongside the bog, Trip had to make a conscious effort to keep his eyes on the road. There was a constant draw to the wilderness laid out beside him, a need to gaze, to become absorbed in that great sponge. His thoughts turned to a time before humans. He wondered if the bog had looked the same then, or if it had even been a bog in those days. It was likely it had been underwater, or a marshy region frequented by creatures which were a cross between birds and lizards. Trip shook his head, and his bicycle wobbled. That wasn't right, he realized. Dinosaurs were not a cross between birds and reptiles, but the ancestors of both. He glanced at the thick brush and foliage to his right, imagining velociraptors strutting between the black spruces. Something rustled in the branches ahead, likely a chipmunk and not an ancient predator. Last fall, the bog had gone through a change that was not characteristic of the season. There was now a chain-link fence surrounding its perimeter. The fence bore no sign, no labels, no indication of who had put it up, but the sight made Trip want to take a pair of wire cutters to it. Every day he wondered who was responsible. It couldn't have been Karen Laurent. As far as Trip knew, Karen would never know about the fence. He sighed again. Try as he might to will away the negative thoughts, this wasn't a good start to his day. This was one of many days in a row to start in such a way. All winter, a shiftless dread had threatened. Passing by the little trees and moss, Trip remembered that his current frame of mind was still not nearly as bad as it had been in January. January had been bad. He pedaled harder and faster, as if it would make him forget that month of nearly insane misery. It was no use. And it was just as well that he remember how god-awful it had been. That way, right now would seem less god-awful in comparison. Was now a russet brown, but in January it had still been displaying its deep red autumnal shades. After so many days of despair and rain, Trip couldn't take it anymore. It wasn't as if something had triggered it that specific night. He'd simply reached a tipping point where sadness and anger had poured themselves into fear, or maybe vice versa. It was hard to say. Trip paced in his kitchen, running his hand through his already agitated hair, frightened that every night would feel like this for the rest of his life, frightened that in order to change this unending pattern of rainy days and foggy evenings spent alone and stuck in his own head, Trip would have to do something drastic and permanent. Something bad. He even thought about calling his mother. If Trip was the type to laugh, he would have found the idea laughable. He hadn't spoken to his mother in months, and it would be callous to call her now just because he needed someone to listen to him being crazy. Then he thought about calling Maddie. Hi, Maddie, it's Trip. Remember that conversation we had too many months ago about dire situations? You know, when we were about to die trapped in a bog fire? When you refused to believe that we were in a dire situation? Well, I have reason to believe we are now. Calling Maddie would not have gone well in this moment, Trip decided. She was the cause of all of this, and he was much too angry with her. In fact, Trip was angry enough to break the promise he'd made with her. Neglecting his coat, Trip bolted outside into the night, foggy again. It seemed barely above freezing, but he didn't mind. Munson Road stretched ahead, lit only by one street lamp. Trip's pace quickened with his thoughts. It seemed more and more appealing the closer he got. Let the bog take him out of this monotony. Let it swallow him up so he could be forgotten, just like it almost did with Jack Caron. Only it took too long with Jack. He was old when he vanished from this world. Old enough for his frown lines to become permanent. Trip wouldn't let that happen to himself. He'd vanish before it was too late. He reached the intersection of Munson and Blueberry. From this point on, the only source of illumination was the yellow flashing of the traffic light. He hung left onto Blueberry and let the darkness consume him. Even after Trip's eyes adjusted, it was nearly impossible to see with all the fog. He found the chain-link fence when his face collided with it. This had been unintentional. Peeved, he then intentionally let his foot collide with it, too. Trip hadn't thought to bring wire cutters, but he knew it would be all too easy to scale. If not, there had to be an entrance somewhere. It turned out he wouldn't have to find the entrance. In no time, Trip was on the other side of the fence, his shoes already soaked through. The shapes of the trees could easily be mistaken for hulking persons gathered in clusters and mobs. His feet squelched as he began to maneuver through the wet blackness, unsure of where he was headed. Soon, he found himself in a familiar place, an elongated mound of moss. This was where they had stood. This was where Maddie had been waiting for something to happen when Trip stumbled over Jack Caron's body. He considered what she could have possibly been waiting for. A confession? An inquisition? Trip realized he was now the one standing on the mound waiting for something to happen. Nothing was happening. He'd at least expected his feet to start sinking, a gurgling noise, a white light in the distance, or even the mockingbird's song. All he got was the faint sound of branches dripping. "Come on," he muttered, hugging himself. It took his feet getting wet for him to realize how cold it actually was. He shivered and considered that perhaps he was standing on too much firm land. He stepped off the mound and into a shin-deep puddle, grimacing. This was insane, he decided. And while he was having insane ideas, Trip had another. Perhaps he wasn't the only one who had made a promise to Maddie. Perhaps the bog had made a promise to her, too. Perhaps that night, after she'd pulled him out of the mud that was so hell-bent on keeping him, the bog had promised to not take Trip away from her and the world she lived in. It was a very comforting idea, so Trip decided to believe it. Months later, with drier feet, Trip still believed it. He hadn't set foot in the bog since, though it was still a daily battle to keep himself from reaching the desperation of that one night in January. If Trip could simply do something, the sense of impending depression would wane, but even with the advent of spring, he was in a helpless hole without her. Maddie. He spoke her name as if summoning. He hadn't realized his crippling dependence on her until she'd left. Perhaps it was a necessary realization. Perhaps he'd need to learn how to take his own initiative, regardless of whether or not she'd return. She would return. He neared the area where Caron Laurent's driveway and sign had briefly taken up residence, though it was a location he only knew by memory. The trees and foliage had recovered from the fire almost as quickly as they had from Caron's brief attempt at her construction project. Trip had no clue as to why or how. That was the frustrating part. He'd take initiative if he had any idea of where to start. All the questions presented to him were dead ends. He couldn't find out what had happened to Karen without her being conscious. He couldn't find out who had put the fence up without them leaving some kind of clue. He couldn't find out who Jack Karen was because most of the folks whose lives had overlapped with the enigmatic man's were now dead, like Jack. Tripp didn't even know where Maddie had found Jack Karen's obituary. He supposed he could try to ask her, but lately his attempts at communicating with her had gone without response. The silence on her end was enough to make Tripp consider giving up altogether. To give up on her, on himself, on life. He found himself at the intersection of Blueberry and Hackmatack, wishing the ride had lasted longer. The motion had been cathartic. Maybe if he biked enough, he could keep the desperation at bay. He had to do something. Certainly there were things he hadn't tried. He hadn't visited Karen Laurent once since her admittance to the hospital. Tripp hated hospitals, and his guilty conscience about her condition wasn't enough to overpower his aversion to medical institutions, but this was bigger than his petty phobias. Something had to be done, and perhaps Karen was the first step. He arrived at Churchy's, slightly out of breath, but no longer shivering. He parked his bike and made his way to the door. As was often his habit with doors, Tripp tried to open it with his foot, forgetting that Churchy's front door opened outward. His knee, followed by his nose, came in painful contact with the cold glass. It was not the first time this had happened, despite the many years of his employment at Churchy's. Opening the door as it was meant to be done, Tripp stepped inside and welcomed the warm air.
"Hey, Tripp!"
Churchy bellowed. "Morning," Tripp replied, rubbing his aching nose. "Has it been busy?"
"Nah, bumps in to see you earlier."
The old man hobbled out from behind the counter to straighten out the sunglasses display he'd done the exact same thing to the night before. The imperfections were only visible to Churchy's keen and somewhat senile eye. "Bud was in?" Tripp asked, hanging his coat. "Doesn't that kid ever have school?"
"Huh, it's Saddy Tripp. Buy yourself one of these, do you some good."
Churchy snorted and grabbed a calendar from another display, slapping it against Tripp's chest. Confused, Tripp gazed at the face of a golden retriever puppy on the calendar for several seconds before realizing what Churchy meant.
"Oh," he finally replied.
"Saturday, indeed. Bud Hadlock must have stopped in during his weekend errands." For an 8-year-old, the boy sure knew how to keep himself busy. Tripp often wondered who knew more residents in the town, Officer Hadlock or his grandson. Since that summer, Bud had developed a strange fascination with Tripp and often stopped in to have conversations mostly comprised of questions. Tripp didn't mind. Without Maddie around, it was nice to have some type of conversation. Between Churchy's incomprehensible sputtering and Bud's hypothetical inquisitions, it was almost as if Tripp had a social life.
"I sure he'd be back before the day's out,"
Churchy continued.
"Speaking of which," Tripp started, "when's the next bus into town after 5 today?"
"6:15,
Churchy replied.
"Well, it would mean waiting around for an hour or so, but I could just suck it up and bike the distance in the cold."
Tripp trailed off.
"Widows need a spray,"
Churchy stated, emitting his own spray as he said the words. Dodging his boss's precipitation, Tripp set to work and fetched a rag and spray bottle. He'd worry about transport later.
Thank you.
Extraordinary Terrestrials is written, read, and recorded by Miriam Rimkunis. All piano music was written and performed by Jonas Rimkunis. All public domain organ music was performed by John Rimkunis. All other music was written and performed by Miriam Rimkunis. Needless to say, all rights reserved. Tune in every Wednesday for the next chapter. The Mockingbird heard at the beginning of this chapter was recorded in New Jersey by Freesound user Hargis Sound. A link to their recording is in the show notes. If you like what you hear, please leave ratings and reviews for Extraordinary Terrestrials on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or SoundCloud. You can also follow the podcast and tell your friends on Facebook and Twitter, as well as the website, extraordinaryterrestrialspodcast.com. Lastly, go outside. Several bogs have inspired the creation of Bloodsworth Bog, but the first ideas for a story about a bog began decades ago, riding to camp while someone's mother told her about bog bodies and glowing vapors. That ride always meandered down a bumpy road, through the Orono Bog. The Orono Bog is less than 15 minutes from Bangor, Maine, and guess what? You can visit it, take a stroll on the boardwalk, and see the moss, pitcher plants, sundew, and hackbutacks for yourself. If you're in the neighborhood, anyway. And hey, if you like it that much, you may decide to donate to the Bog Boardwalk Capital Campaign to make it possible for visitors like you to keep visiting while also keeping the bog the way bogs should be. To find out how to donate, visit the Orono Bog Boardwalk Facebook page or the website, umaine.edu/OronoBogWalk/. At the very least, go outside. Thanks for listening.